The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. The signal goes up to the satellite and then down into your iPhone. It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast. I just looked it up. It's 2 minutes past 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia. And here in Minneapolis, where I'm sitting, flyover country, it's 2 minutes after 10 p.m. I'm Jim Peters. Welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. There we go. I say I did it. Did you hear that? Yeah, I did. Hope you guys are well. I was absolutely shocked, but the Vikings beat the 49ers last night. I don't know how the hell that happened. I talked about this yesterday. I had a cousin who flew into town to watch the game. I trust they had a good time. He sent me a video of their box suite. and I just wrote back. I said, "Where's Taylor Swift?" Oh my God! I'm easily amused, you know, and I shouldn't be because there's war fucking everywhere, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so our guest tonight, Eddie Scarry, the writer and pundit, from Fox News, CNN. You've seen him all over the place. I just want to give you a heads up. He's audio only. He's on the phone, so I have a nice picture of him, and he can watch me. Like, that's exciting. But we talk about a lot of stuff, and we pre-taped this in the afternoon. It's about 50 minutes long. I shouldn't say that because I don't want to dissuade you from watching this because it's actually really cool. He has a lot of cool stuff to say. We talk about his career a little bit. We talk mostly about his book, Liberal Misery. And I pointed out in the interview, the reason I was so attracted to it or the reason I found it is because I was thinking about writing a book on the same subject, but he did too good a job, so I'm not going to. And the book is basically about how liberals and conservatives aren't separated by political philosophy so much as by personality type, which I totally agree. I found that holds very, very true. Tomorrow night, Jeff Meyer, CEO and publisher of Kong News, is going to be here. That's always an interesting discussion. He always has something interesting to say. Maybe not mainstream, but, you know, it's interesting, and that's what we do here. It's a talk show, folks. We talk. Thursday, no guest. I'm trying to figure out, I put this in the show notes, I said open cams, because it's not open phones, no one calls in, you call in with your camera, so I think I'm going to call it open cams. I don't know, it doesn't have a good alliteration to it. If you can think of something else, call me up, let me know. Monday, I'm taking off, I got a dentist appointment. I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk in the evening, I don't even want to try, but the cool thing is Tuesday, it's the Halloween BS Spooktacular. So the deal is, we got some regulars are going to show up here. We're all going to be in costume. It's called the BS Spooktacular. BS for bullshit, because we're not going to talk about anything of any importance whatsoever. And I'm encouraging everybody to call up to drink. You do that in your home remote. And you can call up with your costume too. I hope you do. I'm trying to figure out how to promote this sort of thing, you know. But I don't know. I'll come up with something. So tonight, normally, I constantly bugging you people about calling in. I don't know if we're going to have time tonight. I got to be honest. I don't know if I'm going to have time to take your calls. Last night, in the third portion, part three, I tried to encourage people to call, and I literally had just cut the feed off. I just ended the show, literally, like in seconds, and somebody called. Had a nice chat with a bunch of guys, and they're doing a show on Twitch. And they put me on, and yeah, okay, that's cool. Yeah, I appreciate it. I can't remember their names. I think the show is called Foolish and Ghoulish, if I'm right. It's a paranormal show, too. So that was kind of cool. Guys, if you're watching, I appreciate it. Thank you. I'd love to talk to you again. So, yeah, so Eddie's gonna come up here but we got stuff we gotta talk about right now. Like I said, war is coming up. War is everywhere. So let me give you an example of what's going on in the world. And the thing is, and here's I don't talk about this because when I do talk about it, my liberal friends will say, "You're just exaggerating stuff." Even my conservative friends say this. It's like, no, excuse me. No, it's not that bad. Yeah, maybe that stuff's going on, but not a lot. Okay. I just want to preface this. David Mamet, arguably the premier playwright in America right now, who's also a former liberal like me, who's now a conservative, he went on CNN today and said, "When your kids come home from college this Christmas, don't send them back." And he's perfectly serious. He said, "Nobody should be going to college at the present time." Why? Here's the reason. Harris poll says that of people underneath under the age of 21, 51% of them said killing Jews is justified. I'm not making this up. This is a Harris poll. 1,066 people polled. 49% of the people under the age of 35 said the same thing. In other words, it's half the people that age think that killing Jews is justified for Palestinian liberation. They're okay with what's happening. Half of them. Half of them. That's crazy shit. Can I put it any other way? You know, even if you're for the Palestinians, even if you are, you're actively talking about killing people, but they are. They're talking about that. Okay. Yeah. I'm reading more statistics here. This is crazy, folks. So all these demonstrations on campus, it's about half the students feel this way. About half of them. I'm speechless. You know, I think the woman was named Victoria Holt, who wrote this article in PJ Media, and she said, "You know, sit down. You won't believe this." And she's right. It's unbelievable. What the hell happened in America that half of our kids think killing people is okay? What the hell happened? Okay, I'll answer my question here. This is really interesting. There was another article. Hold on a second. Another article today that said in Hot Air called "Smart People Run the Risk of Being Truly Morally Dumb." And this was another, and I think this is a Gallup poll that found out that the more educated you are in formal education, the more likely you are to support the killing of Jews, which, and that of course makes no sense whatever. But the person, John Sexton, wrote that article, and he extrapolated, he posited that the reason is if you're highly educated, you're used to dealing with abstract concepts. And then the people being killed aren't really people. They're just like numbers. And that's his theory anyway. All right, that's a valid theory. I can go along with that, you know. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's what's going on there, but that's as good as anything. I don't got anything, you know. I mean, what is going on? I do know something that I've noticed something, and Eddie Scarry and I talk about this in the interview, about the fact that it does seem like the more educated you are, the more you throw out common sense or the obvious answer. It becomes contrarian. It's like, you know, it's like you want to demonstrate your intelligence by going against what the ob what the, what con what average people think. You know, that there's that sort of game going on there. But I don't know what to say about this. So Mamet says, yeah, don't send your kids back to school. Make them stay home. And I can't argue with them at this point. It's terrible. Well, the other thing is, I mean, seriously, there's so much BS taught in college now. People aren't actually learning anything useful, relatively speaking. You know, I'm sure some of them are some of the time, but and you can, you know, you go back 40, 50 years, you can say, well, you know, school is mostly for partying anyway. There's a lot of people think that, and maybe that's true, but still, you know, if all your professors are talking about. I mean, I have read just reams of people who have said that their professors, like for even like in trigonometry and calculus, are talking about politics in their classrooms. What the hell, you know? Or that you've probably heard this before. There's some colleges now where they actually think the teaching of math is racist. And that's completely insulting to black people, totally. It's like, well, you can't handle it, so we're gonna shut it off. All right, I'm going to follow that up with another thing that came out today. And that is, and this is hits close to home because this happened here in Minneapolis. I'm talking about the murder of George Floyd, if it's a murder, if. And that's what this article is about. So a former Hennepin County prosecutor, Hennepin County is where Minneapolis is in. Her name's Amy Sweezy. She has sued the former county attorney, Mike Freeman, who she worked under during the George Floyd riots and during his supposed killing, because she refused to prosecute the case because the coroner told her that there was no obvious indication of any injury to George Floyd. He was completely hepped up on drugs. As a matter of fact, there's a long list of drugs in his system. And he had severe heart problems. But there was no evidence. There's no evidence of asphyxiation. There was no evidence of strangulation. There were no bruises on his neck. There was nothing physically, no injuries to his body at all. And so because of that, she refused to prosecute the case. And also, it turns out there's several other people in her office that did too. Her suit is based actually on sexual discrimination, because she said she was the only woman who refused and she got treated unduly harshly. And she thinks it's because she was a woman. She said that the men who refused were not treated anywhere near as badly as she was. So, I obviously don't know anything about that, so I'm not going to comment on that per se. The important part of the story is that the autopsy showed that there was no injuries to George Floyd's body. And they were she called it, quote, supreme premium pressure to prosecute Dan Chauvin, the policeman who leaned on George Floyd with his knee for murder. But even though the coroner said there was no evidence that it killed him at all, none. Matter of fact, it appears, I'm extrapolating this based on that story, but it appears that it was the drugs in his system combined with his heart problem that actually killed him, and not with the actual act of leaning on his neck. So, okay. So the woman who wrote this article, Victoria Holt, she's talking about the fact that she combines this, looks back to the Soviet Union, because she said that one of the manifestos of the communist class is they never created incidents to try to make their point. What they did is they waited for something to happen, and then they pushed that incident, whatever it was, forward ad infinitum. And that's exactly what happened with George Floyd. George Floyd was killed on a Monday afternoon. And on Tuesday, people were asking me, are we going to have riots tonight? And I said, no, it won't be until Wednesday. And they said, why? And I said, because it's going to take Antifa 24 hours to show up. And that's exactly precisely what happened. The rioting didn't start on Tuesday night. It started on Wednesday night. Because all those people from Portland, they had to get on flights to get here. And that sounds like I'm kidding, but I'm not. You know, and we talk about this in Eddie's interview you'll hear in a few minutes, about the fact that the burning down of the third ward precinct here in the here in South Minneapolis. So our and Eddie says, well, he was really cute. Eddie is a gay man, so I suppose his opinion counts. Of that, our Jacob Fry, our young mayor at that time, and I don't know if you remember this, he abdicated. He told the policeman or everyone at the third precinct office to leave because they knew that the crowd was going to try to burn the place down. They were aware of that. So instead of fight them, he told them to leave. They abdicated. They literally ran away. And the crowd just went nuts and the building got trashed. The building is still trashed to this day. They're trying to figure out what to do with it. It appears they're going to build the new third precinct police station in another location and not there. But the building is still abandoned, still burned out. Now, what I said at the time, and it's really true, that is a rational decision by an inexperienced person. Because what happened was exactly what I predicted was going to happen. All right, Fry is right in the sense that if the police had stayed there and basically stood their ground and tried to keep the crowd at bay, there's a good possibility, I'll even say a probability, that somebody would have gotten killed, whether a policeman or someone in the crowd. Someone probably would have died, and maybe even more than one person. That's probably true. And you can say, well, Fry was pretty wise for doing that. But here's the real problem with that. By abdicating, by not standing their ground, every lowlife and pinko communist in the United States looked and said, oh my God, we can take the police. And that led to 3 months of rioting all over America. And I contend that if they had stood their ground at that precinct station, I don't think a lot of the rioting would have happened. It's just kind of the same thing that's going on in the Middle East. I mean, right now, the president, the administrations, they're talking out both sides of their mouth. On the one hand, they're saying that Israel has a right and even an obligation to defend itself. On the other hand, they're asking Israel for patience to see if they can negotiate the release of all those hostages. And like I said last night, that's exactly what Jimmy Carter did, and it led to disaster. I mean, it's precise. I mean, we are reliving history, and that was in 1978, if I'm correct. I think that started in 78, you know, so what is it, 45 years later? It's exactly the same thing. It didn't work then, it's not going to work now, you know? It isn't. And then Gordon Chang is on Fox News this afternoon, and he's probably the premier expert on the Chinese military. As a matter of fact, that reminds me, we got to get Nathan Hsu back on, too, from the Epoch Times, because he's probably the second best guy at this, not to insult Nathan, but he's in Gordon Chang's class, and he can talk about this very well. I got to do that. I make a mental note. He says that Chang says that the Chinese are gearing up for a U.S. based. They're going to declare war against us, and they want to fight it here. Now, and his proof of that is that all the people streaming over the border that's completely open, that there's a whole bunch of Chinese military men who've come in, illegally and clandestinely, and they're basically now they're all over the country. Now, it depends on how you define war, but I don't think there's going to be like a traditional war here in the United States. But what I think is all these Chinese guys are basically going to wreak havoc in a guerrilla type fashion. There'll be, electrical plants will be blown up. It'll just be a constant stream of this, basically to humiliate us and destroy our infrastructure. I got to tell you a story. I've told this story on the show before, but just give you some idea how the Chinese operate. You know, they have a 100-year plan. They've been very, this is public. This is nothing I'm pulling out of my butt or out of quote-unquote sources. You know, they have a 100-year plan to take over the world. So this is about 12, 13 years ago, around 2009, 2010. There's an article in the Star Tribune here in Minneapolis. Now, I got to set this up. So the Mayo Clinic is in Rochester, Minnesota. The Mayo Clinic, arguably and basically generally considered the single best hospital in the entire world. I have to tell you, one of the best things about living in Minnesota, and Minneapolis in particular, is we have health care that far surpasses anything else anyone has anywhere on the planet. I'm not kidding. Between the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota hospitals, oh my man, seriously, this is the place. And we have Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization I have my insurance through. And because it's nonprofit, their goal is not to save their money. They basically they pay out pretty much what they take in. I got an example of that. My wife is a breast cancer survivor, and she went through 3 years of hell starting in 2007. And at that time, this is not a expensive drug anymore, but that was the drug Neulasta just came out in 2007, 2008, just as she started chemo. And if you know anything about that drug, it greatly relieves the pain caused by chemotherapy. It works significantly. At that time, it was brand new in 2007, and it was $5,000 a shot. No shit, $5,000. And Blue Cross said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead." They never even argued it. Neither one of us. I had heart surgery 2.5 years ago. They've never refused us for anything. It's really amazing. So, all right, I'm getting back to my story. So, the Mayo Clinics in Rochester, Minnesota, which is 90 miles due south of Minneapolis. Rochester's a town of about 120,000 people. It regularly makes these lists of best places to live in America, and those people that make those lists have never been to Rochester, because it's not that Rochester's unpleasant, hardly. It's a very pleasant place. It's also boring as fuck. It's like, seriously, there's nothing going on there. And of those 120,000 people that live there, about 60,000 of them, roughly half of them, are affiliated with a Mayo Clinic. In other words, if you took the Mayo Clinic out of there, you'd have a town of only 60,000 people. There's not a lot going on down there. It's been well known for years that privately, the corporate people at the Mayo Clinic, they rue the day that they did not move to Minneapolis. They have a very large building in the center of town here. They do, in downtown Minneapolis. But still, their actual clinic, and it's a very, very, it takes up about half of the whole downtown of Rochester, Minnesota. It's huge. Is in Rochester. So, people, and Rochester has a quote-unquote international airport, so you don't necessarily have to fly into Minneapolis to go to the Mayo Clinic. You can fly directly to Rochester, and people do. But the fact remains that especially when it comes to tourism or that sort of thing, that the people who run the Mayo Clinic really wish they were up here. But the thing is, this was the Mayo brothers started this well over 100 years ago in that small town, and the town grew along with the clinic, and that's what happened. Okay, so in 2010, about 10 very wealthy individuals here in Minneapolis announced that they were going to build a high-speed rail line from downtown Minneapolis to downtown Rochester. The drive is about 90 minutes right now. They were going to cut it in half. Train was going to run at 120 miles an hour. That you can make the trip in 45 minutes. And everyone thought this was a fantastic idea. And not only that, they said, we're not going to ask for any government money to do it. We're just going to do this completely for profit. We're just going to go ahead and do it. Now, in my mind, that's when a red flag went up. Because I thought, well, you know, these guys may have the money to do this or may have the ability to raise the money. Even if you're going to go just off the fares, off the tolls, it's going to be years before they get their investment back. And I thought, I don't know, something smelled fishy. But anyway, that's what they announced. So time goes by, 2-3 years. I don't hear anything about this. My cousin Andy works in the transportation department at the state capitol in St. Paul. And I got together one day and I said, well, Andy, whatever happened to this thing about the Mayo Clinic? He said, yeah, I'll tell you what happened. The state of Minnesota found out that the 10 rich guys were actually a front for the Chinese government. The Chinese government was going to build this rail line and keep the tolls. And the reason they're doing that is one of their goals is to take over the entire infrastructure of the U.S. One rail line, one, you know, power station at a time. That's the way they do it. And, of course, as soon as the state found that out, they cut them off. So I think Chang is onto something here. Like I said, there's going to be an aircraft carrier coming into Los Angeles Harbor. I don't think that's going to happen. But what I do think is going to happen is all these hundreds and hundreds of military guys that got in clandestinely because of the Biden open borders, they're just going to start randomly bombing shit. And we'll never know. We'll never know ever. You know, a power plant here, you know, a building there, you know. It's just, and they'll probably never get caught, and it'll go on and on and on. It'll just be an annoyance. You know, but it's an annoyance where people might get killed. I mean, this is not going well. I mean, I'm not the only person who noticed this. I mean, you know, the shit in the Middle East could escalate at a very, very rapid pace if one or two things go wrong. Now, I've said this before, and I try to be fair here. I think Joe Biden's a total, utter failure. But the only thing so far he hasn't failed at, and I'm giving him props, and I keep thinking it's going to happen eventually because I think the administration and he as a person are so stupid. The Ukrainian war so far has gone okay. Now, I'm not talking about whether you should be for the war. I don't know what to think about the war. I really don't. On the one hand, we are fighting our enemy, Russia, by proxy. On the other hand, it looks like it's becoming increasingly one of these forever wars that everybody bitches and moans about. It just makes a bunch of people in the defense contracting business in the United States rich. You know, so I'm not talking about that position. I'm talking about just the way they're handling it. And so far, they're handling it okay. But I don't think that, although they haven't not handled Israel okay so far, they're in the process of fucking it up. They are. Unless somebody makes some moves here to the contrary, this is not going to go well at all. So, and then another thing that occurred to me yesterday, and I put this in the show description today. And I think this is really important. Do you remember the James Bond movie Tomorrow Never Dies? It was the second movie with Pierce Brosnan, God bless his soul, and it had a character named Elliot Carver, who owned a huge worldwide publishing and media outlets like cable TV news. Everyone thought this character was based on Rupert Murdoch, but apparently that wasn't true. It was actually based on Robert Maxwell, who also was one of these media moguls in Britain, where Murdoch was Australia-based and now in the U.S. Anyway, in that movie, Carver was creating war. He started war. He was instigating war simply so his media outlets could report on it and therefore increase their profits. And kind of, sort of, if you stop and think about this, it's kind of, sort of what's going on right now. First of all, I'll bring this up. There's a poll, and I think it's Gallup. I'm not sure. Only 32% of Americans say they trust the establishment media either a great deal or a fair amount. It's an all-time low, only 32%. Like 81% of Republicans and 69% of Democrats don't trust the mainstream media. Duh. It's like, shit. Why do you think I'm doing this? But it does appear increasingly, especially with this thing that happened at the hospital in Gaza, that the media is almost fomenting this conflict simply so that they can report on it. I mean, look what happened with Donald Trump. They hated Donald Trump's guts, but they also needed him because he increased their ratings and he increased their circulations. There's no doubt about it. You know, since Joe Biden took office in January 2021, CNN's ratings have gone down 90%. And you heard me right. That's not 90% CNN's ratings have gone down. At this point, even in prime time, they're only getting about 700,000 people. And basically, and I've explained this in the past, in terms of ratings for cable TV news, anything under 1 million is zero, basically. And also what happened recently with this war since October 7th, MSNBC lost 33% of their viewers. Why? Because they've got people on. They're Jew haters. That's the reason. And it obviously disgusted a lot of people, even a lot of liberals who watch that channel. They were disgusted by it. So where do those people go? Well, 17% of them went to CNN. Their ratings went up 17%. 42% of them went to Fox News. Now, the thing about that is that Fox News is already beating the shit out of these other two channels, and basically everybody in the cable news business, and Newsmax, it doesn't matter who you're talking about. Fox News' ratings are about, on a typical day, in a typical prime time, roughly double MSNBC and CNN's combined. So if Fox News' ratings go up 42%, that's monumental. And the other thing is, and this is really important, because the ratings for the last 12 months came in recently. And over the last 12 months, Fox News' ratings, this is before this happened, before the Israeli war. Over the last 12 months, Fox News' ratings went up 1%. And you may think, well, that's not very much. But here's the deal. Tucker Carlson left. And so basically, they did not miss him. They got on just fine. I mean, they took a dip there for a while, but those people or other people came back. So that's really important too. But the reason I'm bringing this up because just like CNN needed Donald Trump to survive, you're going to have media outlets pushing these wars simply so they can increase their sales and advertising. No other reason. That seems to be what's happened. And I think this thing about the hospital bombing in Gaza was completely, I think that was evidence of that. You know, I'm not the only person who's brought this up. John Nolte at Breitbart, he's talking about the fact that when the New York Times reported the fact that the Israelis bombed that hospital, they knew that wasn't true. And he's right, they did. They knew it wasn't. They knew when they ran the article, they knew that wasn't true. They ran the article because of all the libtards who read their newspaper, who love to read that shit. You know, and then they go to bed at night and masturbate or something. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But that's why they did it. So they're publishing untruths just to increase their bottom line. Now, that's not unusual in the journalism business over the last 200 years. We had a period of about 40 years from roughly 1960 to roughly 2000 where that shit wasn't going on. But that's actually an exception. I mean, you go back to, you know, the early 1920s, mid-20th century, newspapers were lying constantly. I mean, it was the same thing. They would publish it just to sell copies. And then you have to understand this, too, and I think this is around 1888 or something like that, when the New York Times was the first newspaper in America to actually sell subscriptions, where you paid a monthly fee, you paid a monthly bill, and you just got the newspaper. And that kept, up to that point, all newspapers were sold on street corners, you know, per copy. And, you know, the headlines were always absolutely screaming because that's the only way they could get people's attention. So that also, curbed some of that too. But at any rate, I don't know. Things do not look well, folks. That's all I can tell you. The view here is cloudy right now. We're going to run our interview with Eddie Scarry. Here we go. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Eddie Scarry, author, pundit extraordinaire. How you doing, Eddie?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you. Really appreciate it. You're around a lot, but I don't know if people actually know your background. How did you get started in quote unquote punditry?
Yes, I've been around Washington. Well, really, my entire adult career. I went there straight from college, and actually, I always think it's a fun fact. For me, it just in some sense, you know, how coincidental, serendipitous, I guess, in some way, that I was actually recommended to come to Washington, D.C. to immediately start my career as a journalist, as I wanted to be, by a man named Clarence Page. I'm sure you've probably heard the name. I'm sure a lot of your listeners and viewers have probably heard of him, even if they don't remember him. But he's a long time, I assume he still works, maybe not, but was a long time columnist for the Chicago Tribune. He also was on, you're actually going to have to remind me, what was the PBS, the McLaughlin Group?
Yeah.
Remember the McLaughlin? Yeah, so he was one of those regular liberals, actually, who was on there. And he came to my school one year. I went to just a small liberal arts school in South Carolina, and you know that's where I grew up. And he came one time to speak to the journalism students, and I asked him. I said, "How do I do what you do? How do I go on TV? If I want to write books, if I want to write a newspaper column, how do I do that?" That sounds a little bit quaint in retrospect, a newspaper column.
Yeah,
but. But he said immediately go to Washington, D.C. He said go there because there's all these jobs in journalism, political journalism. They're constantly needing people to be on TV just with the 24-hour news cycle. Get on. You'll be able to get on eventually. And he was right. That was really, really good advice. It was just funny to come from such a staunch liberal. And I am decidedly not.
Yes, but Eddie, but, let me ask you, were you yeah. ever a liberal? Are you a former liberal?
Was I ever? Not really. I was very apolitical, and in an indirect way of answering that, I was fairly ill-informed just because I didn't bother being informed, which I always believe by default makes you a liberal.
Okay. Yes,
but I will say instinctively, if you asked, and even back then and even to this day, I would have never considered it left or right. And I think that there are people that I've looked up to throughout my career and throughout my life who I think that they were the same. My sensibilities, I would have always just described them as American. I've always just felt like a very distinct and identifiable and describable sense of what it means to be an American. I see a lot of those qualities in people like, Bill O'Reilly, someone who I've met, someone who I like. When I used to watch him on TV, he was kind of the first person who got me engaged in the news and the news cycle and politics. I see similar qualities in Donald Trump. And there are others. And I just always had an innate sense of what it meant to be an American. And I think that can oftentimes put you closer to the right side of things when it comes to the political spectrum, at least.
So I hope you don't mind bringing this up, but you did put this in your book, so I'm assuming this is public knowledge now. You're a gay man, and as a general rule, gay men are liberal. I'll share a little story with you. I'm a straight man, but I used to work for a gay organization for many years. And I remember there's a gentleman that belonged to that organization who was basically, and I hate to use the term, but it fits well, he was a closet conservative at that time. This is 20, 25 years ago. I'm a really old guy, Eddie. and I remember asked him, I said, well, how can you belong to a party that doesn't want you, you know? And did you ever feel that yourself? I mean, I don't
know. In fact, I will say it's a somewhat unique experience, and I might be generalizing in too much when I say that to be gay is often just to kind of by default be liberal, because I know so many right-wing gays in D.C., but I will say even more so, perhaps even the further you get away from D.C., there's these kind of wannabe metropolitan people who live out in, even where I'm from. In South Carolina, or you might even say like Tennessee or Kentucky or something, and they think that by identifying as liberal and with progressive causes, that somehow gives them this cool factor, and like, you know, they're somehow being associated with, you know, the New York or metropolitan lifestyle, and how cool is that, how classy, how elite. I think there are some of those, but there are actually far more right-wing gays than I think that I let on and what my impression was. But I will say in D.C., did I ever feel that there was? I don't like to talk in terms of party as far as where I identify. I often vote Republican. Probably when there's a gun to my head, I'm probably almost always going to vote in a national election for a Republican. But I just like to think of things on either the right or left. And I never felt like, and in fact, probably the opposite. I would say that when it came to people who were either more Republican or traditional or conservative, they were often so delighted by me and were kind of intrigued by I guess because of the same reason you're asking me this question. They were just kind of intrigued by my background, why I am the way I am. But in fact it was liberals and Democrats who I've never had a problem with, and I know we're going to get into this with my book. I've never had a problem with them on a personal level. Or at least I used to not.
Yeah, well, here's the problem. They have a problem with you.
That is the problem, yes, and that is exactly why I wrote the book. But that was anything that, because I still, you know, I'm a fairly young adult still. I like to think so. And just coming through my younger adulthood in Washington, D.C., you realize that you make a joke or you make a comment or an observation on politics that doesn't fit within the orthodoxy, that doesn't reinforce the narrative that they push every single day. But when they wake up, when they go to sleep, if you stray outside that, you are going to get dragon fire breath breathed on you.
Yeah.
From the left, from Democrats, from liberals. And that really was my experience. And I will say that's something I observed over a course of years, but it wasn't until when I finally wrote Liberal Misery, I think I did that between 2020, the end of 2021 and 2020, going into 2022. That's when I kind of really realized that this is something much, much deeper, bigger, and a bigger pattern, and I'm not the only one who's experiencing it.
So I got so many questions now. First of all, I do want to point out that I learned working for that organization years ago, like you said, there's way more gay conservatives than anybody knows. And that's still, I still think that's the case too. Now, the weird thing is, I'll just bring this up. Don't need even a comment. It's not true of the women, but it's true of the men. The gay men, there's a lot of gay conservative men. I've learned that. The other thing, so
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And some of them are still, quote-unquote, in the political closet. There's a lot of people who still don't want to raise their head. But let me tell you how I found your book. I found your book about a year, year and a half ago, because I was thinking about writing a book on the same subject, and I wanted to see who had done it, and... You basically wrote it, so I gave up. You know, it's like, you know, it's somebody already did what I was going to do, and that's fine. But what actually prompted you to write the book? Do you remember?
You know what it was. So actually, let me ask you one question real quick.
Sure.
Actually, don't even worry. Let me ask you. Do you have certain language things that can't be said on this? I
no.
just want to be sure I don't.
No, no, no. As a matter of fact, I swear like a sailor. It's terrible.
Okay, yeah, and I'm not a particular, well, I can have a foul mouth. I will not be in professional interviews like this, but this
that's
is
okay.
One of my favorite stories. One of my favorite stories, though, is about the origin of this book, because what happened was it was actually going through 2020, and just a little bit of personal information. I had at the end of 2019, I had gone through a breakup, and so now in going into 2020, I'm trying to start dating again. It had been several years since I had actually had to try dating. Well, you look at what happened during 2020. We're during an election year. We're during COVID, so lockdowns. And then on top of that, you've got the mostly the fiery but mostly peaceful George Floyd protest.
Yes. Now, I'm in Minneapolis too, so this is, you know, this is ground zero for that sort of thing. Go ahead.
Exactly. Exactly. And in Washington, we had very, very. It wasn't nearly as bad here, but we had the same kind of violence. We had the same kind of destruction of private property, public property, demonstrations, all of that, boarded up downtowns, all of that. So it was a very depressing time just on its own. But given the that it was in an election year with all these things happening, just I noticed that people were just so much more miserable. Like people, and you might think that's like, well, yeah, kind of like just given the atmosphere, the environment. But then I realized that I'm in arguably the most concentrated city of liberals and Democrats, and in a city where, you know, politics is all the time. I'm going on these dates to the extent that you would call them dates. And, you know, everything was closed down, so it was either someone had to come over for drinks or
yeah.
I had to go over to their place.
Uh-huh.
And of course we're talking about these subjects, the biggest topics, the pandemic, the election, and it would end up in an argument almost every single time. And it's like, all right, well, then I guess that one's over. Not going to see that guy again. But it struck me that we're arguing not based on, we're not even sharing the same facts. I mean, I have to live and breathe this stuff. I looked at the data. I knew all the COVID stats like by the back of my hand. There was no, as far as COVID spreading and who it was affecting, it had nothing to do with politics. It was an airborne virus that simply spread. And, you know, when New York got hit, then the next thing would be Florida. Then it might be California. And like, there was literally nothing to do with politics or even policy that anybody could really do to slow this thing down. Other than, I think, like Ron DeSantis did in Florida, which was to say, okay, these are the people we need to protect. These are the ones who are basically going to be fine, who we can trust to be fine. So let's work at it from that angle. So the extent that politics could really and policy could be involved anyway, that was the right way to go. That was the sane approach. But otherwise, there was just so little that you could really do about this. But they did not want to hear it, and it was always coming from it was always Republicans. The Republicans, they're the ones who are screwing everyone up because they're the ones that want to open, and they're so resistant to wearing masks. And it just flew in the face of all data. But then I started noticing the pattern, and what I actually kept saying to myself, and what I wanted the book originally to be called, was "Why Are Liberals So Bitchy?" or "Why Are Liberals Such Bitches?" One of the two. I wanted it to be something like that. And the only reason it didn't end up like that, and I think we ended up with a much better title anyway, a much stronger title, but the only reason it didn't end up that way was because my publisher, he thought that because we rely, as an author, you rely a lot on media attention and going on radio, going on TV, Fox News first and foremost. And if they're not going to show the graphic of the book, if they're not going to say the name of the book on TV, or just may very well just not have you at all because there's profanity in the title, you don't want to name your book something that you can't get on TV, you can't have them say it on the radio.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, how did that guy, wasn't Mark Malone? That book, he called his book, what was it, something about being fucked up? I always wonder, how did he get that passed? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Actually, that name sounds familiar, but I'm not sure about the book. I mean, you could we I could have fought it. I mean, my publisher originally was open to that title, and I think that it just eventually dawned on him. He's like, this is a really strong book. We got a really good shot at this making an impact. I think we need to like go a little bit safer on the title. And we still had some fights about that, actually. What I will say was, it came they wanted to eventually call it. I settled on Liberal Misery. Him and his partner at the publishing house said, we want to call it Liberal Hate, and they were very, very sold on that. But I didn't like it, and I said, hold on, the number one show we're aiming for to get on, if assuming we're talking Fox News here, is obviously Tucker Carlson. That's who's going to sell you books. This was when Tucker Carlson was at Fox, and so I texted his two of his producers and Tucker and said, what do you think? It should be Liberal Hate, or should be Liberal Misery? Only one producer said he liked Liberal Hate, but was kind of between the two. But both far and away, Tucker and the executive producer actually said to me, no, it has to be Liberal Misery. That is the exact word that you're getting at. So that's what we came up with. But yeah, but just to circle back to your original question, the book and the reason why I wrote it was based on personal experience. And it was, I was going to kind of write this, ranty type book. I wanted to put like some real effort into it, but then I started looking up, is there evidence, is there any data to back up my idea that liberals are naturally and tend to be meaner, nastier people than conservatives? And weirdly enough, I believe it's chapter two in that book, there is so much data out there backing up this that my exact thesis. I was
Yes.
so happy to find it all. I mean, it's as sad as it is that it is true, but this book is not just a rant. This is backed up by so much data proving my point.
That was the reason I was interested in this, Eddie, is because I noticed that too. Virtually every study ever done on this says that liberals are significantly more neurotic than conservatives. And at this point, as far as I can tell, I don't know if you found this, but basically the liberal community has given up trying to change that narrative. Now they're trying to justify it. Oh, we care more, or we care too much, or all that sort of rot. But no, it's really amazing. I mean, you're right. There's real studies that have done that, people have done on this. And yeah, no, they're messed up.
For sure. And it was wild just how granular it got. It was just that you could pick what term you want. You could say liberal, Democrat, progressive, you can use them interchangeably, but, and it was without like, and like, for example, they did one, they did surveys on college campuses. I think the one that's pretty consistent about this is, I forget what school, I think it's Duke. It's somewhere in North Carolina, actually, but it was, they asked, they do this like kind of political survey of the students, and they would ask them like, are you less inclined to, or more inclined, depending on your party affiliation, to want a room with someone of the opposite political ideology or political affiliation. Are you okay with studying, having a study buddy? Democrats, it was always like at least like 30% more if you were a Democrat, you were less interested in associating in any way, whether it was rooming with a Republican, whether it was studying with one, whether it was dating with one. That even there were studies that showed that if you're a Democrat, you're more likely to not want your child to marry a Republican than it was the other way. If you're a Republican, you were more likely to be okay with someone who's a different political affiliation. And it was wild just how many circumstances you saw, like, just these surveys got really creative with it. And then I think also more telling was that it was another survey of different college students, or it was a study based on multiple surveys of different college students. And it just showed how, if you're a liberal, you're more likely than conservative or Republican to be like less satisfied with your job, less satisfied with where you live, less satisfied with your marriage and your family. I found that kind of wild to believe that anybody even admits that, whether it's an anonymous survey or not.
Yeah, right.
But just it was really something to just see how many studies and surveys. I mean, all your listeners and viewers, you've got to understand. You read this book and you just see, just it feels endless, and it can feel very exhausting. But hopefully, I made it pretty fun, entertaining to read.
Yeah, you know what else you did, which I think is a real plus. It's not too long. It's like, you didn't try to pad the book out. It's like you got to the point, you make the point, you got your examples, and you're out. That's what I like about it too. You did a very, very good job.
Thank you for that. And yeah, that's somewhat one, because, well, I mean, first and foremost, I've done, I think that book runs around like close to 150 pages or so, liberal history.
Yes, right.
I've done about three books like that, and I've done one that was more like tripled the size of that, and I will tell you that writing one that's even as long as Liberal Misery, 150 pages, if you get up between 120 and 150, it is still a slog. It's about 3 months, and I don't take time off of work. I might take a week off to do some editing, but I don't take time off. I do my normal daytime job. I'm working weekends now, and I'm working nights. That's when I'm doing my book, and it is just a real slog to write a book, no matter how long it is. But when you get to that really like long, long thing that takes you about, a year plus before you finish editing, and then you've got to now worry about publicity and booking, shows, and it's all up to the author anymore. The publishers barely do anything. It's just, it's a lot of work. But also, I understand that readers, they don't, it's cheaper to buy a smaller book like that. I think Liberal Misery was only about $17. If you're buying one of these bigger books, it runs about $30. And I don't blame anyone who says, all right, that's a little bit too steep for me. So when you get around to like $17 and it's 150 pages, they say that's a little bit more within my budget. And I try to be also really respectful of that.
And it's also a budget of time too. People, if you got a 400 page book and you only read half of it, there's a weird sort of guilt about the fact I didn't finish it, or maybe I missed something, something like that, Hey, I want to get back to what you're talking about, all these studies. So this is the part I don't quite get. How did wearing masks end up becoming a symbol of liberalism during the COVID thing? How did that happen? I don't understand it, because I mean, like you said, every medical study said the masks were totally useless. I mean, and that was known at the time, even. It wasn't even retrospect. How did that become a symbol?
There is no, you cannot underestimate the, and I hate to give Trump too much credit for doing this to people and having this much consequence for one singular figure to have been. I mean, like, I respect him so much for everything he did. He revolutionized the entire party one-handed.
Yes.
And reoriented the entire, really, not even just one party. He really changed the entire country and the
That's
trajectory
true.
Of everything.
Absolutely. Right.
But it's just kind of wild that there are so many things that you can actually look and say, it's because of Trump. And actually, that tends to be true for when he was doing his COVID task force and would bring, Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx and all the rest in front of the podium at the White House and would have these things. And oftentimes the reporters would say, well, why aren't you wearing a mask? And where's your mask? And why didn't you do the mask? And he just said, that's not really for me. I really do believe there was such a strong reaction to anything that he wouldn't do or did do. Liberals said, we have to do the opposite. Like anything, and I will even go so far as to say, if you really think about the mess, the absolute mess we are in internationally, starting with Ukraine, first and foremost Ukraine. So much of that, of Democrats handcuffing themselves to Ukraine and saying we will do whatever it takes and as long as it takes. This is the Democrat Party that never was like this before. They were so opposed to wars, and you know, you look at the Middle East and with Bush, and it was just anti-war and we can't do war. Now they're all for war. And
yeah.
Really, what is it? You go back to Trump impeachment 1.0. That was all because of his phone call to Ukraine, and then you get Russia involved in that. Well, now because we felt like he was a little bit too sympathetic towards Russia and a little bit too hard on Ukraine. Well, we got to do the exact opposite. And so I would say the same thing with the mask. They saw that Trump wasn't interested in wearing one. They saw that, they also decided this whole charade with the science and the experts and thinking they knew everything. And this is something you have to do. I really do believe it has so much to do with Trump and his aversion, I guess we'd say, to wearing the mask so early.
Eddie, that's a really good observation, because the thing about them doing opposite everything Trump is kind of sort of obvious, but I never thought about the fact that he personally weren't to wear a mask, and therefore they're all going to wear them. I never thought about that. That's really cool. That's good. So,
thank you.
okay, so you wrote a book called Privileged Victims, and the interesting thing I find about this is that this book is from, what, 2018, is it? No, 2020.
Victims,
2020.
That, yes, I wrote it throughout. I think that one took me like a year and a half. So, but it came out, I think, in either February or March of 2020.
Yeah, and so, but you kind of sort of preordained or predicted kind of it's. I mean, it's oblique, but the border crisis in this book. I mean, about everyone coming through the border and saying, you know, it's like, you know, I need asylum, I'm a victim, all this sort of stuff. Can you explain the concept of what privileged victims means?
So privileged victim was actually that I don't think I was necessarily the first to have spotted this trend, but I knew that it was coming, and it was coming very fast, and at the moment that it was coming, which is now we all refer to it kind of lazily as woke, which woke has, you know, is an like a kind of a hybrid of all the terrible things that you've heard throughout your life, going back to, you know, political correctness,
yeah,
and everybody gets a trophy culture, that kind of thing. But really what I was looking at with privileged victims was, where did this all start? And that's, there's one chapter, it's the hardest chapter to get through the book, I believe it's the second one, that's just all about the actual intellectual, ideological and philosophical roots of, if you want to call it wokeism. I still prefer the term social justice, because that's how they kind of, this all this stuff comes from the college campus.
Yeah.
It came from Europe. It made its way to our intellectual elites and on the college campuses, and that's where it has festered and rotted and spread ever since. So I was really just looking at, where is this idea that, you know, there's the oppressed and then there's the oppressors, and what that, and how that shapes so much of our culture anymore. I mean, you can look at pretty much any issue in this country is tainted by this, whether it is the border, because obviously it's, well, these are people who are fleeing destitution, and we have plenty to share, and we have no right to tell them they can't be here because they're poor, because they're the ones in need. Okay, well, why can't I consider my needs? Yes, I do live in a high rise in Washington, D.C., but, you know, that's, I don't know why I need to suffer, why I need to see my neighborhood and my fellow citizens in some way give up something. You look at any one of the cities, whether it's New York or Martha's Vineyard or, you know, L.A., and suddenly they have to, or Chicago, where they have to give up their playgrounds and their recreation centers, so now that they can house migrants who
right.
have absolutely nothing, nothing to their name, not a cent to bring, nothing to offer. They don't even know English most of the time. I mean, why is it that now? Because I had a nice life, now I have to somehow reduce myself for this other person. I mean, and you look at Black Lives Matter, same exact thing. I mean, when you look at what it was you're asking for, what it was you want, it started with like policing, you know, some policing reforms. Well, we tried that. We tried the bill that was championed by Tim Scott, the Republican in the Senate, the perfectly fine bill about policing and how we can adjust police departments, federal legislation. Instead, the conversation so quickly within a, you know, the drop of a hat went from that to, Well, no, I think we're talking about reparations, and there's opportunities that actually white people should probably take a step back. Straight men take a step back. Men in general take a step back. It's time for somebody else now. Joe Biden saying, okay, when he was running in 2020, I need to for sure 100% my running mate is going to be a black woman. Okay, I mean that's just the social justice stuff. That's just and where did it come from? That's what I was tracing in privileged victims. Unfortunately, some things during that year took a little bit of a front seat, and privileged victims had to take a back seat. So it wasn't quite the success I was hoping it was going to be, but still a very, very timely and relevant book.
Yeah. So I just had a brain fart. I'm sorry. This is what happens when you're
No
68,
worries.
Eddie. Don't get 68,
Yeah.
okay? Okay. So, okay. Oh, Jesus Christ. God damn it. All right.
It happens. It
Yes,
happens when you
it
talk a
happens.
lot.
Okay, yeah, that's right. It does. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, you were talking about the protests of 2020. I find this, I don't know if you agree with me on this or not. So here in Minneapolis, I don't know if you remember, but so the third precinct police station was burned down. Jacob Frey, their mayor, a young guy, very inexperienced. And as a matter of fact, that's my big thing about politicians in general. They generally haven't done anything before they become get in office. He decided that he was going to he asked the police to abdicate the station because he thought if the police stay there and defend it, people are going to get killed. Now, I think on the surface he's right about that, but here's the problem. By abdicating the station, he basically gave a signal to every dirtbag in Antifa in America that, oh my God, we can take the police. And I actually think that led was the very beginning of the Summer of Love in 2020, where 20 some people got killed and there was $2 billion of damage in 20 different cities. I mean, do you have any thoughts on this or anything?
Well, I remember that guy, a very good looking guy, but a waste of looks. He was a complete retard.
Yeah, that's true. Right.
I saw him. I don't know if you remember that there was some protest, and this was, I think, the first flicker of Democrats suddenly realizing, wait, what the hell have we done? Which was, he went out there to some pro one of the 50 billion protests, mostly, I think, black people at this point. And I think they started chanting, or I don't know if they wanted him to also say defund the police or what, but he wouldn't join whatever it was they were saying, because I think even him, he suddenly realized I look like a crazy person.
Yes, that's correct. That happened, right.
And then they booed him out of there. They booed
Right.
him, and he's like he walked out with his tail between his legs. I mean, you laugh at it because what else can you do? But no, I think that you're right, that once you start giving into to any of this stuff, what do you end up with? What you end up with is people like Kyle Rittenhouse. You end up with people who say, okay, well, this is political violence is not going to be, and I've written about this a lot. I would have liked to have gotten into it more with liberal misery, but I think I hadn't, it wasn't a fully formed idea quite yet. But political people just standing up and saying, okay, political violence is not going to be accepted and tolerable from only one side. And I think that's what a lot of what January 6th was about. We went through a year of absolute hell with one side, and I always refer to this refer to what happened in Washington and every other city in the lead up to the election. So all the boards and all the storefronts, the boardings, they had come down after let's say around like September, because the George Floyd rioting, it had mostly subsided. But then once we're getting close to the election, I live in Washington, D.C., downtown. I worked near, very, very close to the White House, where I used to work. I'm not there anymore, but at the time I was. And once the election's coming around, those boards went right back up. They went
Yeah.
right back up in front of every restaurant. And now that was not in the anticipation of a Biden victory. That was in anticipation of a Trump victory and what Biden voters might do. That had nothing to do with Trump people, because there's very, very few in like the big cities anyway, like especially like in Washington, D.C. That's all Biden people. That's all Biden and Democrat voters. So that was that threat and that hostage situation, which is what it was. It was basically saying, if this election does not go the way that we need this to go, we are really going to screw some stuff up here. We
Yeah.
are really going to take it to you. And that's what we saw. And you can't You can't tolerate that kind of thing. Otherwise, you end up with people like Kyle Rittenhouse. You end up with the McCloskeys down in, what was that, in Missouri? Or not down in Missouri. That was it Alabama? I can't even remember. It was that
It was Kenosha, Wisconsin.
No. It was somewhere down south, and I think the woman Corey Bush, I think now represents their district. And I'm talking about the McCloskeys, and there was a man and a woman who came out.
That was
broke into Saint, the gated community.
St. Louis.
Yes, that's right, and I believe that's where Corey Bush now represents. That
yes,
Democrat
I think you're right.
There.
Yeah.
So the, you know, you've got people who come out and they, you know, they see people bust into their gated community. They come out with guns and say, "I'm, you know, this is not the place for that, and I'm not messing with you." And what? And everyone gets upset about, you can't come out here with guns. You can't cross state lines to defend private property. Well, no, BS. Yes, they can.
Yeah.
And that is the exact situation you're going to get when we start having, you know, these district Democrat district attorneys, Democrat governors, Democrat mayors who say, all right, it's a free for all. So long as you're a Democrat, so long as it's in the name of social justice, we're not going to crime is legal. Crime is legal. So long as you say it's in the name of social justice.
Let me run
and
some.
So, Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Let me run something by you. You're talking about January 6th. My theory is that if Trump hadn't been at that rally, the same thing would have happened. I don't think the Democrats understand at all what happened on January 6th. You got a bunch of people who are really, really pissed off, but like you said, about everything that happened the previous year. That's what it was about. It wasn't about Trump. You know, they think, oh, you know, I have friends who actually, liberal friends who actually think Trump has some hypnotic control over a lot of his fan base, and he doesn't. You know, that's my personal feeling. I think if Trump hadn't have been there, the same thing would have happened, because those people are just mad, and they have a right to be mad. You're absolutely correct, you know?
Yeah, that is honestly such a smart point, and like, I agree with you, and I have said things similar, but I never thought to put it that way, which was, because I just said the same thing, that it really wasn't about him. I do think that, and I have written, that they believe they were doing something that he endorsed, and I don't like that. I think that was wrong. I had written at the time, and I don't regret it, that at the time he should have resigned. That's nothing to say about him running for president again, whatever. I'm fine with that. At the time, I thought they there were enough people there who believed that. But it is also true, and I had written many times, that this he was so beside the point, and this had to do with months and months of absolute hostage situation, as I described it, hostage situation, which is if this election doesn't go our way, we are really going to screw up this country once again. And it's only been 2 months before all those board fronts went down. And then on top of that, like I'd never seen before, but I never thought I'd seen in my life, was American strangers. And I'm sure it happened to you. It happened to me multiple times. It happened to me in Chicago a couple times, and it happened to me here in DC a couple times. Absolute strangers coming up to me and screaming at me because I'm not wearing a mask. And I mean, that is just a situation where there are people in this country, good people, who are going to say, you know what? I sat through a year of this. It's enough.
Yeah.
You know what? And now I'm just as pissed off as you were. I always say these people decided this is not going to be a country where political violence is tolerated on one side and everyone else has to deal with it. No, that's not what it's going to be. And that is how you end up with January 6th. But that was a really, really good point, that I agree with you. If Trump hadn't been there, the same thing would happen.
You alluded to this in Misery too. The fact that basically all the all quote unquote misery, the title of your book about Trump, was not created by Trump. It was like created by the left. And then the left said, well, if you want this to stop, you have to not reelect this guy. And that's absurd. Now, the thing is with Trump, so you mentioned in one of your books that you've talked to him. He calls you, right?
Yeah, that was for my very, very first book. It was that was Fraud and Fiction, which was a response and a debunking of fraud and my book was Fraud and Fiction, response to Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, I think that's
what
the book was called.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just find this amazing about the fact that they set this up. They created all the chaos. And the problem, you know, the thing is, I don't know a single Trump supporter, which I am, who doesn't know that, you know, think that Trump talks smack half the time. He does. You know, you can't get around that. But the actual chaos was all created by the left, and then they turned around and blamed Trump and said, "Well, you know, if you want to get rid of this, you can't reelect this guy," and that's absurd. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that was and the megaphone for that was the media. You know, I have these two girlfriends of mine who I just really think that they are the average voter, to the extent that you can think of an average voter. That's probably different in everyone's mind, but one of them lives in Arizona, so a fairly purple state. She does not have children, but is married. And then another one who lives in Indiana, a more right-leaning state, but has children, is married. And they're both, we have these conversations, and they're both one a little bit more political than the other, but neither of them super, super political people. They're more just like, they look at their own situation, I think like most people, I would like to think like most people, and say, what's going to make my life better? How do I, like, what's going to get any better than this? And what it was, you know, just in conversation with them, was them saying, you know, I can't handle all the noise. I can't handle the chaos and the drama with Trump. And to some extent, I agree with it. I think that he does not help many situations. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, when you got people like me who are trying to explain impeachment and how absolute BS and absurd and ridiculous impeachment over Ukraine and this phone call and Alex Vindman, this complete nerd, you know, when you're trying to like wage those real fights, and then Trump goes on Twitter and calls LeBron James a loser or something like,
yeah,
that. I just,
right,
feel like it adds to the, you know, we need, there are bigger fish to fry.
I agree with you. He does not help his cause a lot of the time. That's true.
Right. But at the same time, I would say to them, like, who exhausted you? What was it, because he tweeted, or was it because you had someone like Jake Tapper who goes on TV? This is in my brain forever. There was a segment I watched it live on TV where, you know, Trump had just gotten, he had just basically recovered from the virus. It almost killed the president, by the way. So he recovers. That should be a situation where everyone goes, thank God. Thank God that the president of the United States is you know, he's okay.
Yeah.
No matter who it is. But, you know, because Trump sent out a tweet that said something like, don't be afraid of the virus. Don't let it dominate your life. Then Jake Tapper on CNN, he goes on TV and says, how absolutely heartless. And how could he possibly say that? And it's so insensitive. And you know what? He tells his viewers, he says, if you are scared, that's okay. And if it has dominated your life, that's okay. I mean, a completely innocuous message, harmless message. In fact, I think the right thing to do is to say, don't let this overwhelm you and control your life. I know that you may have lost loved ones, but we all have to go on. Like, that's a pretty strong message. And I think like anyone would say that, but for Jake Tapper, he goes on TV and says, you know what? No, that's wrong. And actually it should dominate your life and you should be afraid. And that's all okay. I mean, this was the media and the left creating the chaos that they did. Because why? Because they didn't like the outcome of the 2016 election. For the first time in my lifetime and many people's lifetimes, an actual outsider, someone who actually said, I'm going to change the way the way Washington works. And the interest is not going to be on behalf of Washington anymore.
Yeah.
It's going to be on behalf of the average American, the people who actually pay our salaries. And in fact, Trump never took a salary, which is nice. But I think that it really was just the media and the left that drove themselves insane. And they basically said after 2016, and they have said ever since, and that's what I love and hate about my book, is that it's just so true, that they basically said, if we're going to be pissed off, you're going to be pissed off. I am going to ruin the party for you too.
Yeah, but you brought up a good point here. Now, I read Liberal Misery about a year ago, and of course I picked it up again to prepare for this interview, but I can't remember if you actually addressed this in the book. What is the thing with liberals? It seems, I mean, it's amazing. They seem to be afraid of everything. Now, I have a theory about this, but did you write about this? I can't remember.
Do you mean afraid in terms of, like, you know, what do you mean by afraid of everything?
Yeah.
I think that there's a neuroses.
Yeah, okay. So when I mean by afraid of everything, I mean basically almost everything. I mean, the COVID was the obvious thing. I mean, I think it brought it to the forefront. But, like, for example, here's a survey I read that if you ask a conservative how many people get shot in America, or how many unarmed black men get shot every year, the actual figure is about 32. This is from the Washington Post database. Most liberal, most conservatives will say maybe 100, but most Democrats, most liberals will say thousands, and it's completely off the mark. I mean, they're paranoid. They're afraid of everything. I was going to say my personal thing is that, I mean, and this is really sexist. I'm going to get shit for saying this, but I look at liberalism, kind of contemporary liberalism, as kind of a feminine construct, and women seem to be more afraid generally of stuff than men. I mean, I know people are giving me shit for this, but I still believe that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and worried and anxious. I think that those are all like fear, anxiety, neuroses, worry. All of that, I think, does perfectly describe so many Democrats and liberals and people who vote Democrat. I will say that there is the element of I would say they're probably the smarter version of a Democrat and liberal. It's that they say, well, we can use that anxiety and we can turn that into votes. So there,
yes,
are the people who know better, but they turn it into votes. But the thing is, what I did find, and I think that there is still an interesting book to be read about this, because I don't know the answer to it, and maybe there is no answer to it. But what I found looking at, actually, if you're looking at donations, political donations, donations to causes you believe in, nonprofits, those types of things, but have a political affiliation or a political cause, if you're looking at those, and regardless of income level, whether you're a janitor or whether you're a CEO, if you are liberal, you are more likely to send money to those causes. Now, so what the way I interpret that is that you simply care more. You really do. And that's something that I think it was a very disappointing answer for people when I did interviews or did a few talks about my book. They would say, so what do we do about this? What do we do about the liberal misery problem? The answer is you simply have to care more. You have to show up at a school board meeting. You have to be able to when a liberal starts acting up in a social setting, you have to say, cut it out. When they start with the protest and they start the violence, you have to say, knock it off. We're not doing that here. And I'm not going to just go along to get along and be quiet because, you know, I want to make peace with you and I want everything. I think the average independent person, right-leaning person says, I just want to have my family. I want to be safe. I want to go to Outback and have a steak dinner. I want to go on a cruise. I want to go to a social setting and have drinks with mixed company. Liberals live and breathe. They wake up, they go to bed thinking about politics.
Yeah.
And that was a reason why I included that study, just showing how regardless of income level, you can make no money or you can make all the money in the world. You are just more likely to give money to these causes. Because they really do just care. I think, but I really do think there should be a deeper dive and probably a full book. I don't know that I'll be the one to write it, but there needs to be more exploration of that.
But you've touched on a really good point. That is, it's perennial. Basically, forever, Democrats and liberals have cared way more about government and the machinations of government than conservatives, and because of that, they have more influence just because they care more. You're right. Conservatives, they just want to go to work and go on a cruise, you know that, you know, and the liberals wake up and go to sleep thinking about politics. So therefore, they have a certain amount of undue influence for that reason alone. I just basically restated what you said.
but it can't be said enough, because I think it's. I was talking about this with my colleague David Harsanyi, who's a columnist, like really great, really smart guy at the Federalist as well. And we were talking of, I forget what the topic was, but I remember. What he said was that because oftentimes what he does, or like, you know, for a living or whatever, if it comes up when he's around his wife, he often feels like he's embarrassing his wife. And I said, yeah, I was like, you know, what is true is that there is no one there is no anxiety like the anxiety felt by a right-leaning person in mixed company when politics comes
no
up.
Shit no
that
shit
was, that was no shit and that was one of the like again one of those things that I realized, and it took me some time, as you know, just like kind of you have to experience things and notice patterns, but I realized it was like, well, I suddenly realized that I didn't want to talk about what I did for work. I didn't want to describe it. I didn't want to go into detail, and I could be very evasive. And I remember during the 2016 election, ahead of the 2016 election, I went to meet someone for drinks, like kind of like a date, but we met for drinks. And I remember him asking about, because I like the way it works, and this is when I worked with the Washington Examiner, is like some people went to the Republican convention to cover it, some people went to the Democrat convention. I went to the Republican one, and he said, oh, what, the guy that I went for drinks with, he said, oh, that they must have been, that must have been crazy, right? And I said, well, I heard that the organization at the Democrat one was actually a lot worse, and I heard there were a lot bigger protests. And he said, no, I meant like what they said on stage, the types of things they must have been saying. And I suddenly realized that, okay, we probably don't agree on this, and I need to change the subject.
Yeah.
And it became that way from there on out. I suddenly realized, like, this isn't stuff I can talk about without it becoming a fight. And it's not because of me. I do it for a living. It doesn't,
right.
And I don't take it personally. I've always felt, and I write this in my book, Liberal Misery, that our differences on politics are supposed to be settled with elections. After that, best of luck to you. If you lost, best of luck to you next time. If not, you know, there's another one. There's another election every 2 years, at least on the national, like, give it a rest. But no, liberals don't. They don't give it a rest. It's every single day. And I think they really have realized since 2016 that, you know, there is going to be no rest. This is every single day for them.
But Eddie, I do have to ask about this. I hope you don't mind. I mean, okay, you're not hugely famous, but people know who you are, and especially in D.C., I'm assuming that socially your reputation precedes you. I mean, doesn't it? I mean, you meet people who don't know who you are.
Yeah, no, I do, because I mean, the way I would say it is, I mean, for sure, when it comes to people, I mean, like, because the internet's there and all my work is pop.
Yeah, right.
Right. So oftentimes when it comes to, you know, if you're chatting, you know, over the phone or chatting via, you know, some kind of social media thing, you know, or app, you know, some kind of dating app. I don't want to tell people like what it is I do and where I work for, and like 100, like, I don't want to say my full name exactly, because then, you know, oftentimes people, I've never done it, and I guess I understand the temptation. I don't care enough, or what, I'd rather meet someone in real life and get to know them, and then I'll get my impression.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, they want to look up and get a background first. And for me, it's like, you're going to be slammed over the head with how I think that, how I think that liberals are miserable all the time. But yeah, no, I mean, it's not easy. I have lost friends over the course of the last few years. I've lost many friends. There are situations I just don't even think it's worth to put myself in. So yeah, not famous, but it does come up, and it has created friction.
and I'm going to mention this just really quickly in passing. I really appreciate your time here. Then you mentioned this in your book too, and the fact is, and every survey and poll I've seen shows us that conservatives look at politics as a difference of opinion, and liberals will look at it as a way to cut you out of their lives. I mean, I'm not making that up. Every survey I've read says that seems to be true. So,
yeah, I think that I included many where it was there were people who, so if you were a Democrat, you were more likely to say that you unfriended or unfollowed someone on
right.
social media because of a disagreement of opinion. You are more likely to say you're not interested in having a friend who's the opposite of the
relation.
You're not interested in dating somebody. And like I said, going back to the college one, you didn't want to room with someone who had a difference of opinion. You didn't want to study buddy with somebody. I mean, I myself have experienced it. I'm sure that any one of your listeners has had that same experience. I hope not to the extent that others have, like I have. I mean, it can be very very sad, but it does happen, and I hope that everyone who reads the book reads it knowing that they're not alone. That was one of my one of my goals, is that you read the book and realize, okay, it's not just me, because that was what I was thinking. I was like, is it me? Like, is it what I'm saying? But I realized, no, it's not just me. This is a type of people, and I'm not the problem.
If you accomplished any one thing with Liberal Misery, it's that. I think you gave some solace to some people. You're right. It's not just me. Hey, let's end with this. You have any predictions for 2024, both politics and maybe otherwise? Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people, like I interviewed a guy last night, who really, there's a lot of people who think there's a lot of doom and gloom coming. Do you see anything?
Here is the problem that we have right now with 2024, is that Biden, we're looking at the polls, right? And
yeah.
To the extent that you can actually believe them at all, you have Trump who's polling either evenly or ahead of Joe Biden. The problem is the Democrats have created this system that I don't know that we're ever going to turn back from, where we've flooded the entire, every corner of this country. Under every bed, there's a ballot. There's people harvesting them. They're going to people's houses, knocking the door, saying, "Oh, fill out your ballot. I'll help you with that." That has distorted our elections so bad that it's hard to believe the polls. It could be so believable. We could end up in a situation. I would say if Biden's numbers drop to 20% approval rating, it would not surprise me that he still won the election because of the way that they've rigged this balloting stuff.
Yeah.
I hope that's not the case, but it's very hard to make predictions with what we've done with the COVID and the mail-in ballots and the ballot harvesting, the absentee, extended voting periods, all that stuff. So your guess is about as good as mine.
But I'm totally with you on that. I agree. I think the whole thing's become so perverted that at this point it might be very, very difficult to win. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. I hope we can talk to you again.
We will do it. It was fun.
Yeah. You take care, all right? We'll see you soon.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That's Eddie Scarry. His book's called Liberal Misery. And we will put it up on the blog, our show blog at germanite.com tomorrow. One of the coolest things about doing what I do is being able to talk to interesting people like that. I just enjoyed that thoroughly. I hope you did. It was a nice conversation. So I'm going to end for tonight. Here's the deal. Speaking of good conversationalists, Jeff Meyer is going to be on tomorrow. He's the publisher of Conk News. You might not agree with what Jeff thinks, but he's always got a unique take on everything. And that's why he's worth listening to. He will make you think. So that should be a good time. We'll take your calls. That's going to be live tomorrow. So we'll be taking your calls the entire time. Thursday's open cam night. Whatever. I'm still working on this. We're going to, you call up. We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I'm taking Monday off, and then Tuesday you got Halloween. You call up in your costume and what you're drinking. Anyway, thanks for watching, everybody. Really appreciate it. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. We'll see you tomorrow.